Hello, and welcome to On Staging, a community theater-focused discussion podcast highlighting the development and staging of community theater productions in Calgary and the surrounding area. I'm Kyle Gould, and today I am delighted to have, I think, a little bit of a celebrity because I've seen his name everywhere but never had the chance to meet him, Jeremy McKenzie, former co-founder and co-artistic director, I think, of Gas and Light Theater.
Yeah.
As well as what we're most interested in today, the director of Workshop Theater's production of Moon Over Buffalo. Jeremy is a celebrated community theater director and participant, having been involved in community theater for over 30 years. In fact, Jeremy is wearing a Move Over Miss Markham sweatshirt from 1995 that I believe was one of your first, second?
My second production with Workshop Theatre, yeah.
Goodness me. Nonetheless, welcome to the show and thanks for sitting down with me today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This is a treat for me because I have seen Moon Over Buffalo before.
Oh.
Very few are the shows that I have had a chance to see before. I am not a big community theater buff. I haven't seen a lot of shows. I haven't seen a lot of plays until taking on this podcast, really. But Moon Over Buffalo was done by Morpheus Theater 5 or 6 years ago, and my wife was one of the stage managers.
Oh, okay.
And one of my good friends was the director. And so I got a real inside view when I got to hear their stories coming back and then getting to see the show put up live.
Well, that'll be interesting to see.
I'm excited.
How different, if anything, our production is.
It should be quite a bit different because, you know, different visions and different performers lend to an entirely different outlook of the show. And I may know what is going to come and what is going to happen and how all of it plays out, but the way it plays out will be so different. Have you done Moon Over Buffalo before?
No. No, I've wanted to do this play forever.
How long is forever?
Well, many, many years. Gas and Light would love to have done this play.
Oh, okay.
But we basically performed in the Joyce at the Pump House. And there was simply no way, at that point at least, that I could see how we could do this show.
Right.
Because of the scene in the second act that is set at the beginning of Private Lives. No Coward's Private Lives.
Right.
So I couldn't see how we could do that. There's simply wasn't room.
No, there's like an upstairs and stairs and doors. And you're right. The Joyce just seems too small and too tight.
So a chance to do it in the Victor was, I couldn't miss that.
So how did you come to be associated and connected with this project?
Well, I've been associated on and off with Workshop Theatre for obviously over 30 years.
Right.
I haven't been working with them over all that period because I was with Gas and Light for a long time. But
right.
I kept in touch and was a member on and off. And I was on the board recently through the pre-COVID and COVID period. And then I've actually retired because I'm getting old.
Congratulations. That's
and then
awesome.
I said, you know, I don't want to do this anymore unless somebody offers me a good role.
Okay.
So Workshop came back and offered me the role of Scrooge in Christmas Carol.
Yep.
Which I did twice.
As one should.
So then I thought, well, what are they doing next year? And I put the idea forward that we should look at doing Moon Over Buffalo. And in the end, they decided they would, seeing as I offered to direct it.
Oh, great.
Finding a director is always the tricky bit.
Right.
You know, you can choose plays, but finding
Absolutely.
A director.
Absolutely.
So I said, well, I'll direct it because I would like to anyway.
Yeah. So when you pitched the show initially, did you pitch yourself as the director as well? Or?
I didn't initially, but then I thought, well, it won't do it if I don't direct it. So.
Yeah. And you've wanted to direct it itself
yes,
for a
I
while
did.
Yourself.
I, so. Yeah, I thought, yeah, this is, I like Ken Ludwig's plays. I think he's a very, very good playwright.
He really is.
Because he writes wonderful comedy.
Yeah.
My whole
understandable
theater career
comedy.
Has been comedy, by and large, anyway.
Oh, okay. And so, when did you get your start in theater?
When I was 11.
Wow.
With the Mikado.
That does not, really, with the Mikado. That's amazing. So, was it an Amdram in England?
Yes, it was.
Nice. Whereabouts?
In my hometown of Leicester, in the East Midlands.
That's wonderful. And what was the Amdram Society called in Leicester?
It was called the Bronson Evening Institute.
I love
Operatic
the names.
Society.
I always love the names.
Basically rehearsed at a night school. Certainly in England at that time, it was possible to actually use the schools
right.
to rehearse in or and so on after school
Absolutely.
Hours. Seems to be very difficult these days.
Yeah,
but so that's where we... And my mother was one of the lead actors in the company.
Was she Yum Yum or Katisha? Who did she play?
She
in
played Katisha. Well, she was one of the Three Little Maids the first time I did. Okay. I think that, and I did it twice with them, I think.
Yeah.
In my teens, and then maybe the second time she directed. I can't remember.
It's fair. It was a long time ago. What year was it?
God, when I was 11, so it must have been 53,
oh,
I guess.
Wow.
Which is interesting because that's the year in which Moon Over Buffalo is set.
Right? That's incredible. I've been listening to Patrick Stewart's autobiography, and of course he got his start as well as an 8-year-old in doing Amdrams in his small town in England as well. So I like hearing these stories because Nicola Payton, who's also from England, her start in Amdrams as well. And so it's really interesting to know how prolific the community theater is in England and where it builds up and develops these families and careers and professions for people all throughout their lives.
Yeah. In Leicester, when I was there, there were three companies that did Gilbert and Sullivan.
That's incredible.
At least two a year. And then there was also the Amateur Dramatic Society and the Opera Society, right, who just did opera.
You know? Wow. So,
I mean, people sort of went from one to the other. And
I'm thinking back then in 1950, they still had to pay rights for Gilbert and Sullivan.
Gilbert and Sullivan. Oh, well, the rights were, I guess, not too onerous monetarily, but the real problem was that it was still under copyright.
Yeah.
So it had to be done exactly as Gilbert set it.
Exactly.
And you couldn't change anything. Change a word or even the blocking.
Right. Which is what's interesting about it now, because you can do so many different things.
Yeah.
And Morpheus Theatre's next year's The Mikado, they're doing it, but it's a Scottish version of The Mikado.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Because I directed The Mikado for Morpheus way back.
I know.
Which in the Joyce, which was fun with 20 odd people in the chorus.
Wow.
In that one little dressing room.
What? In the Joyce, The Mikado.
Yeah.
With 20
It's a
people.
Very simplistic set.
Wow.
And a piano accompaniment. And it went pretty well, actually. It sold out.
That's incredible. I mean, it's been a very long time since The Mikado has been done in Calgary by a community theater company. So I'm excited to see it.
Haven't Morpheus done it since? I don't know.
No, they have not done it since.
Oh.
Just because of its being set in Japan and the constant state of the costumes and the implications of racism that come from it, which I totally understand in a present day.
I guess we didn't think about that.
No, you wouldn't have thought about that. Neither did Gilbert. He just, and I mean, they brought people from Japan. You know what, Kyle? This is not the Mikado podcast. We're going to pull back.
The costumes, it was Dale Fay who works with
Dudney.
Dudney.
Yep.
She designed the costumes. She won awards with those in the States.
Yeah.
She took the costumes.
That's amazing.
They were fabulous.
Her set for the current Hansel and Gretel that's up with Dudney right now is just phenomenal.
Yeah, she's good. She's very good, actually.
Yes.
I worked with Brian way, way back when I first came to Canada. So I've known Brian for 40 years or more.
Yeah, the only person I've worked with is their son, Scott.
Oh, okay.
Was
well, I know Scott since he was a kid.
I know. The Fays are a foundational group within community theater here in Calgary and the area. It's very nice. So Moon Over Buffalo has been something you've been thinking about and wanting to do for a really long time.
Yeah.
And you finally pitched it to the board at workshop. But when was that last year? I would think it would be January, February of last year.
I think it may have been in the summer, actually, because I remember talking to my wife about it when we were out for a walk in Fish Creek. So it must have been not the dead of winter anyway. So spring probably. And I've suggested this to workshop and I'm thinking that I might direct it. Can I do that? Because it's a big commitment living here in the South. That means, charging up and down Deerfoot three times a week.
Yeah.
Which is getting more onerous now I'm getting older.
Right. Yeah, it is a process. But as a retiree, hopefully you're seeing the delight in getting out of the house and doing something productive.
To be honest, I have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I haven't found the driving too bad so far, anyway.
Right.
And of course, I did the two Christmas Carol versions that we did. So
right.
Same thing, really.
Yeah.
I wasn't directing it. Well, I started to direct the first one, but then we couldn't find a Scrooge. So I was co-directing it with Evan Davies. I decided in the end I'd do Scrooge and he'll direct it. So
perfect. Well, that works out best for you.
Yeah, it was good. I really enjoyed doing that.
So you've pitched it to workshop and they've said yes. You've pitched it to your wife and she said yes. And I totally get that. You know, you should always communicate with your partners before taking on large projects like this. When were auditions for this production?
I think they were at the end of February.
Of this year.
Yeah, February. It was actually the week that their rule of thumb closed.
Right.
In fact, I think it was during the show, because I think we had auditions on the Monday, because that was the dark night for Rule of Thumb.
Right, and a whole bunch of people from Rule of Thumb auditioned to be part of this production.
Yeah, they did.
And my understanding as well is that a bunch of people from the Morpheus production of the Peacock season also jumped at the chance to audition for this show as well. How many people came out for auditions?
I think we had about 30 or so.
That's a great
But I had a real
a
problem
like
casting the lead.
Oh, why is that?
I didn't have anybody the right age who could do it. So we've cheated a bit in getting Tim to play it. We're going to have to make him older, but he's just doing a wonderful job.
Oh,
so
that's wonderful. Tim who?
Tim Hanna.
That's wonderful. And he's done a bunch of workshop productions
in the past?
He's
done certainly some, yeah.
And you've had to age him up for the
character?
We
will have to a little bit, but not a lot, I think. Age doesn't really matter if you command the role. And,
exactly.
It's three generations in the play, right. as you know. There's the grandmother, and then there's the couple, George and Charlotte, and then there's Roz and Paul and Eileen, who are obviously younger, and Roz is the daughter, so there's got to be enough gap there to allow that to happen.
To make it look like that guy could be that lady's lady's dad, yeah.
But I think it comes over. I think.
Oh, good. And so you did your auditions. You had 30 or so people come out for this production. That's great. How do you normally run your auditions?
I like to do cold reads.
Do they come in with a prepared piece or just straight with cold reads?
I know a lot of people do bring a piece. I tried that once, one production I did.
Yeah.
And it was actually for The Importance of Being Earnest.
Oh, okay.
And I had all these girls come with these dreadful, sad tales about, oh, my baby died. And,
I
thought, this is a comedy.
Yeah.
You know, this is a.
You just start specifying comedic monologue. Yeah.
And I was so depressed. I decided I'd never do that again.
Absolutely.
Do cold reads. I'd rather. Do
so
cold
do
reads
do a,
myself as an actor.
Do you do a cold read from the play or a cold read
a
from
cold,
something else?
Usually a cold read from the play. I want to find out whether people could fill that role.
Right.
Can they understand what they're doing? You know, are they the right age, the right, what, are they look right? I'm casting a role.
Right, absolutely.
I'm not looking to find somebody's strong points. I'm looking for somebody who fits the role.
Yeah, that comes with a degree of knowledge of the material as the director going into auditions. Sometimes a company will ask a person to direct a particular play. They won't have even read it before they say, oh, you know what, I think I would do that. So they may have read only once or twice by the time auditions come around to have a strong working knowledge of who these people are and how they're going to portray that character.
I don't think I could work like that. I need to know the play. I need to see it in my head.
Yeah.
Which probably, to some extent, limits me when it comes to casting, in that I can see in my head what I want. I don't always get it.
Right.
But that doesn't matter, really.
Yeah.
As long as they start with something, then you know what it is you don't want, if you like. I mean.
Yeah, you're looking for a specific look and a specific type and voice
and
that in your head.
And the ability to deliver the lines. Now, I know some people find cold reads difficult.
Right. Like performers finding cold reads difficult or directors?
Performers. I think earlier in my career, I came across an actor at a cold read. It was actually for a workshop. And he was awful. And I thought, well, he's not going to get it. Really. They cast him. He's a brilliant actor. He just can't read.
Yeah.
He just can't do cold reads. He can't pick up the script and just read it.
It requires a degree of immediate intellect and foresight into the character.
I mean, that's the way you are. So I try to make allowances for that.
Yeah.
And usually it works. You know, there's usually a little something there that you know would work, even if they're not aware of it at that point.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know I had somebody come to audition for... Golly, what was that? Might even have been that Mikado I talked about. Somebody who arrived late, she had no prepared song. She couldn't think of a song to sing, so she sang Happy Birthday.
Perfect.
And she got the role of one of the Three Little Maids. She was brilliant.
That's amazing.
Whereas other people would come, you know, sort of a full aria, and no, they don't quite work. For some other reason, they could sing the role maybe, or they could say the role, but... They don't look right.
It's tough. You have to find the right person to engage and find it. Like, is the audience, when you're casting, when you're doing auditions, do you think about from only your own perspective, or do you also try to think of it from what is the general audience going to get from this particular performer?
That's interesting. I never really thought of it like that, but that's an interesting question. I guess the answer is no, I don't. But,
that is
but maybe
answer.
I should.
I try to think about the fact that like this audience is, I am the viewpoint from the entire audience's perspective. And so I want to see that whole age range. What are the teenagers going to think when they come see this show? What are my grandparents going to think when they come see the show? How will this person embody that character? And these are the attributes that I think that character has. How will they
be
viewed by
the group? I think that would be probably more important if for a drama.
Right.
My chief objective, as far as the audience is concerned, if they see the play, is they laugh a lot and they come out feeling happier.
That's wonderful.
Which is why I like comedy, which is why I do comedy. It's supposed to make them feel good. I don't want to depress the audience. And there's a lot of drama out there that really does.
Good for it. It might be artistically
wonderful, and it might say some really significant things, but if it depresses me, I don't want to know.
Wow. I think it's important that we have that full range of emotions visible to us. And I think that we shouldn't shy away from seeing it and from doing it, because I think that it enhances the human experience.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I've been to dramas and come out thinking, wow, I mean,
I'm changed.
And they really stick. I mean, I was lucky enough when I was still in England to go to Covent Garden to see Birgit Nielsen doing Salome, which is the most depressing, awful show.
The music's
terrifying.
Yeah.
It is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen on the stage.
Wow.
But it was fantastic. The singing was brilliant, of course, but there wasn't a laugh in it.
And it still stands out. It still
and I can still remember
it
vividly.
Right?
So, sometimes I suppose it works, but by and large, the plays I do, I want people to enjoy and to laugh.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping with this one, they'll laugh a lot because
good.
The cast are still laughing. In fact, that's one of the problems I'm having is stopping them laughing. And they think it's funny and they've done it a lot.
Right? Oh, I would love to dig into that in a second. So when you pitched the show to Workshop and they cast you as the director, did you have to go and find your production team to put this together, or did Workshop?
Well,
we sort of talked about this with Workshop in the past.
I would, and then I didn't really have to. We've got Jackie's brother. Jackie's our president, and her brother did the lighting for the last couple of shows, I think, and he was happy to do the lighting for this. So I got the lighting guy, Evan Davis, has offered to do the sound, which
that's
he's
wonderful.
Done many times before.
Isn't it his turn to be Scrooge, though?
I wanted him to be in this, but I didn't think he doesn't really look old enough.
That's great. And who's your stage manager?
Difficulty finding a stage manager. Emily Brennan has been stage managing a lot, but she's also running doing the administration. She
is far too busy to do it all.
So she didn't want to do it.
Fair to her.
And then, in fact, Anna Brash came and offered to be stage manager. She's interested in learning, in getting into stage management. She's been working with Workshop for quite a long time through her school years as backstage. So she said she'd do it, and she's doing a fabulous job.
And you must be old hand with having been a director and a producer and worked for so many years with community theater that you were able to help someone who's a little bit newer with all of the nuances that come from stage management.
Yeah, she hasn't really needed it.
That's great.
When I'm directing, I just want somebody to write down my blocking and notes, because I can't remember the next time I did it.
I do it all on the fly.
So
exactly.
And she's taken copious notes, and I'm lucky that my granddaughter has done two or three plays with Workshop, but she's now interested in getting into the technical side. So she's going to be an ASM.
And who's that?
That's Molly Nordstrom.
Oh, wonderful.
She was with me in both productions of Christmas Carol. She started off the first as one of the Cratchit kids. And then last time she was the Ghost of Christmas Past. So,
and now she's the ASM for this
show. She's one of the ASMs, yeah.
And that's great, because you definitely need backstage management on this production. This is a complicated show that requires a lot of doors.
We discovered just the other night that there's some entrances where people are entering at the same time from different places. They can't see each other.
They have no idea that they're doing that. Yeah, I remember that.
So
they need to be cued. I believe a gunshot happens.
Yes.
A picture needs to fall off a wall. It's a complicated backstage environment.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful.
That's what we're going to be working on tonight, actually.
And who's building your set?
Well, Workshop have got most of the set. I mean, we've got stacks of flats.
Yep, but you still have to pick them and put them in place and design how it's going to lay out.
Yeah, well, I did the design.
Okay.
Which was fairly easy. I mean, the play's about doors, basically.
It really is. It's a farce.
there's five doors.
Yeah.
So once you've got those in, there's not a lot of room for much else, except...
It's true.
Plain flats in between them. Yeah. And a platform, this raised platform, which we've got.
I always find the problem is you got to find five doors that are all the same sort of.
Well,
otherwise, yeah. You've got five very different doors.
Susan has very kindly donated five doors or four doors that fit. One is different.
And that's Susan Sobrovich?
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And her husband, Ben, has built the set, basically.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah. Or at least put it together.
Look at all this. I mean, you're really showing how much like the community comes together to build a production here.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of people lately who are like, I did that and I did that and I directed and I produced it and I did it all themselves. But you've really got a whole team of people who've come together to build this production and bring it to life. Does the production team meet every other week? How often do they get together?
No, actually, we haven't really met.
Ever?
No, I sort of talked to them individually. I've been to lots of production meetings. You all sit around the table for several hours while each person talks about their particular thing. It's easier to go and talk to that person on their own.
Exactly.
Rather than them have to listen to everybody else. They don't need to know that, you know.
No, they don't. Although sometimes it is helpful.
Somebody talks at great length about ticket sales or whatever. It's just not helping somebody who's there to talk about sound.
It's really hard for the set designer and the set builder to sit there and listen to the costumer expound about, you know, how complicated it is to build these skirts.
I've had lots of conversations with Jackie about costumes.
Yeah.
Because we have all our costumes in the space. So, you know, she can drag things out and say, what do you think about this? Yeah, that'll do. Yeah.
That's great.
But then, I talked to Evan every now and then about the sound and Richard Goth came in to watch the show and the lighting's pretty simple for this. It's just a wash with a couple of specials.
Yeah.
And we're doing the balcony scene without, I was originally planning on having a roll-on wagon with the balcony on it, but that was too complicated in the end. We just said all we really need to represent the balcony is the railings.
Yeah, that's all you need.
And that's all we're going to have.
Perfect.
Which will have to be lit differently from the rest of the set, but basically that's it. Well, the opening piece too with the battle or the siege of Arras in Serrano, we do that a little bit differently too. But
and so then you started having rehearsals for the actors once you've cast everyone and you finally cast Tim Hanna in his role and you've got everyone together. What do you do to get this cast that needs to gel together quickly and become a codified, unified group? Because it's a farce. Every single line has to be right on top of the next line. And the pacing is so important in this sort of thing that you need people to have a certain degree of chemistry, connection, understanding of each other.
I'm very lucky they have got together really quickly. They all seem to get on well together. We all went out for a beer after rehearsal on Saturday. Most of them have worked with some of the people at some time.
This is their second show they've ever done. Some of them have an old hat at having done, you know, multiple years of productions. But did you do anything yourself as the director to get them to come together?
Not really, no. I mean, we start off by doing a read-through.
As you do.
And so everybody finds out who everybody else is and what they're doing. And because it's a funny play, you know, they laugh and they're feeling good about themselves. And then we just start blocking.
Wow, right into blocking immediately. Did you have any character-related discussions and sit-downs?
Well,
and
I talk to them individually usually about their who I see.
Do you schedule that as part of the rehearsal or is that just a phone call?
No, I'll just, during rehearsal, I'll talk to them about, do you realize why this? And do you see this? Remember, this is 1953.
Right.
And things were different. And they all seem to get it pretty well. The thing I haven't done, which I do sometimes, and I think I should have perhaps done this, and I learned that from Bill Torrey, was to get them to all think about their backstory.
Right.
Which I always think is useful. I might even introduce that tonight. Just to give them a bit more thought about why they're here.
Yeah.
The script is fairly explicit as to why they're all there.
Exactly.
They understand who they are from the script. Because they all talk about themselves.
If you can ground the character and give yourself some foundational roots, it gives you a leg to stand on should anything go awry. I find that a lot, that if you are well and truly connected to your character, then you can respond to something happening that might not, and this is community theater, this is live theater, it's going to happen. Somebody's going to forget a drop a line, a light might burst on the stage, that picture might fall accidentally in the first act. You need to be able to respond and react to that in character that'll allow the audience to go, was that supposed to happen?
Yeah.
And not go, ooh, that wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah, I can hope things like that don't happen. But they do. I've been there.
Right? We all have been. And honestly, that is part of the joy of going to live theater.
Oh, absolutely it is.
Because yeah. As the audience, you're looking forward to something going wrong. You don't want it to happen. You definitely don't want somebody to fall and smash their face, or you don't want something terrible to occur. But the offside chance that it will happen is the only reason you're going to live theater. Because you could see a perfectly produced version of Moon Over Buffalo on TV, and it will be edited with the director's vision adhered to in all ways.
Yeah.
It's great to be able to know that something could go off the rails.
Yeah. Scratch my ear. I think that's what I like about theater.
Yeah.
I know I've done murder mysteries with people who do movies, basically.
Yeah.
And they've said, how you do that? I mean, you have to do it again tomorrow night. Yes.
To find that emotional connection every single night, not just one time.
And it'll be different.
Yeah. It'll be a different way to get there. That's true, too.
Yeah.
So what kind of director would you say you are? You've been doing this for a very long time and grown up in the theater and surrounded yourself and built your own directorial habits, as you said, from Bill Torrey, but doubtlessly from countless others. What kind of director do you think you are?
I think I'm an actor's director because I'm an actor, basically.
Yeah.
Who directs. I'm not a director who acts.
So are you one of the direct, because you're an actor's director, do you get up and mime the scenes to people too?
In the way that I think I would like to be directed.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I've worked with some good directors in the past, but all the years with Gas and Light, I was the director. So
right.
We did three shows, I think, with Bill Torrey, and they were all... So I learned a lot from him on that.
Bill Torrey, we are a genuine loss here in Calgary. We should have had him for another 20 years. He would have built an entire generation of directors and understanding production people here in Calgary that we don't have.
I was lucky enough to do, funny thing happened on the way to the Forum for Front Row Center with Bill Torrey.
Wow.
The only show I've ever been involved with in any way, we hit the stage on opening night, absolutely on top, and we stayed there for the whole run.
It's Bill Torrey. That's
it was
a
lot
Torrey
of work
effect.
We put in.
Yeah.
Singing and dancing. We had a choreographer who was really strict.
As they
worked
are.
Worked us really hard. She
so
was lovely.
Many of them are.
But gosh, I'm no dancer. So.
I have found choreographers to be more strict than any of the other directorial roles. Choreographers are... Yeah, they are so in the body that, you'll find a very mentally connected director who's like, oh, I want to see more. I want to see you experience that. And musical directors are like, I just really want you to sing the right words at the right time with the right notes.
Yeah.
But they want that emotionality that comes from it. That's up to you to generate. But for a choreographer, I want your hand here and I want your foot there and you need to be stepping in time. 5, 6, 7, 8, go.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They are less empathetic as a group.
I started in Calgary. I mean, I started in the Midlands when I was 11, but I left home in my late teens and didn't do any theater then for 25 years or more.
Oh, wow.
Getting married, having a career, having children.
Yeah. Did you think about theater during that time?
Oh, yeah. I couldn't avoid it.
Why'd you give it up, though? I mean, your mom didn't.
Well, because I moved away from town. Okay. I moved 100 miles away to Essex, and there wasn't a theater company, wasn't a community theater company around. And it just, I did other things, but I
As
never lost
do.
Track
yeah.
of theater. It was nice that we could get up to London occasionally and see
shows.
Something. And we also had a good theatre company in Southend, which we went to quite a lot. Yeah, I was involved. I watched theatre, but I didn't get involved till we came to Calgary.
And then when did you come to Calgary?
In 82.
82. Oh, my goodness.
Because I worked for Dome, and then Dome got taken over by Amoco.
Yep.
Amoco, for a brief while, had a choir.
Okay.
Which I decided it'd be rather fun to sing again, because I obviously singing with Gilbert Sullivan.
Right.
So and I did, and then I enjoyed that, and then my daughter actually pointed out an audition for the Calgary Gilbert Sullivan Society that was just being formed.
Right.
She said, go and audition. You've done lots in GNS. Well, I had done 5 or 6.
Yeah.
So I said, all right, I'll go. I like singing the chorus. It's nice,
Right.
And enjoy the chorus, because that's all I ever did before.
Growing up.
And I went for the audition, and I didn't have anything to sing. I'm a bass. You know, I never get the melody.
No, in Ruttigore you'll get it, but yeah.
But Stan Kane, who was the director, auditioned me, and I sort of sang a few things, and I said, you know, this is great. I'd like to be in the chorus. I don't want to do. So he said, yeah, sure. So the first concert we did, I had three solos.
What? And oh, that's incredible.
You talked about Ruttigore. I ended up doing the Death part.
Of course, that makes perfect sense.
And I really enjoyed that. Well, I enjoyed working with Stan, but it sort of fell apart financially, and he was simply trying to do too much. He didn't have the team. Like I have, you know, so
right.
He had to do so much of it himself, and he got sick, so that sort of collapsed, and that was when, actually, then we formed the Cappuccino Singers, which is now Cappuccino Players, it also. Well, we were just the singers, because we just wanted to sing, so we did a few concerts singing songs, and then we started to put a bit of a plot to the songs, and develop basically our own musical using other people's music, and we did that for several years, and then I got... Again, I was doing a lot of solos. I found singing solos very stressful. And then I found just being a straight actor, delivering lines.
An
I can do that.
Easier thing to do.
I can do that.
So what was your first play?
The first play I did in Calgary actually was Fools. It was a sort of a one-off. So lady put it on in the Victor. Really, I think, so that her son could have a role.
And are we still in the 80s? Or
I don't know. Yeah, I can't remember when that was. It must have been...
Right.
Must have been close to the 90s. Must have been about the 1990s. What did I say? This was 95.
That's 95 on your
shirt.
Must
have been about 92 or 93.
There you go.
My daughter was in it, but I only had a part in that because the guy that was playing the role dropped out. Being my daughter, said, oh, dad'll do that. My dad'll do that.
That's great.
Oh, okay. And I thought, yeah, I like this, just standing, saying lines. It's a lot less stressful. I don't have to listen for my note. Or again, because being the bass, I always had, in the quartets and so on, I always had a line which bore no resemblance to anybody else's.
No, it didn't. And you just had to maintain the rhythm. You were there to make sure everybody was on beat.
I pulled it off, I think.
Good.
Actually, but it stressed me out. And I stopped singing really then. And
well, that's too bad for both yourself and everyone else. I mean,
what? Well, apart from doing, I did two GNSs with Morpheus.
Oh, wonderful.
Because we did the Pirates first.
Their very first Pirates.
Yeah. And I played the Major General.
That's incredible.
And I was able to help by bringing in a lot of the guys from the Gilbert and Sullivan Society, which is sort of on the verge of collapsing at that point.
Right. And then kind of Morpheus took it over.
Morpheus took it over, yeah. And then we did the Mikado. Sean was tied up with moving house and having the baby and everything. So I directed that for him. And
it's so long ago.
Yeah, so long ago, yeah.
Sean's kids are both grown and out of the house, and out of school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
it's that long ago.
Oh, yes, it was, yeah.
An entire new generation of people has been born since then.
Yeah, because then it was doing that we had a team, Rob Fulton doing production and directing it, and then we had a pianist and we had a musical director and so on, and we all sort of got together and said, why don't we do this ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't sure that Sean was going to go on and do more GNSs at that point, so we said, let's do our own. We were going to do the Gondoliers.
Yeah.
And that's why we were Gas and Light. The Gas was Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, that's so interesting. How many people know that
Nobody.
Gas stands for Gilbert Rob and Sullivan? Well, there you go.
But we couldn't cast it. We got halfway through rehearsals and we could not get the
rest
singers.
Of the people that you
and so we abandoned it and did a play instead.
Well, that's wonderful. And Gas and Light went on to do a whole bunch of productions, generally one a year.
Yeah, we started off doing two while we still had more than just Rob and I, but then people sort of fell away a bit.
As they do.
Teresa Maley was still part of us then.
Yeah.
She was our stage manager for a long time, actually. Very good stage manager.
I find that each show is a family of its own, a little, you know, encapsulated group that comes together to build and make this thing happen that only exists for that short period of time, and then they're gone.
Mm.
And very few of them stick around from one show to the next to the next.
That was something that was new to me, because in the UK, it tends to be the company.
Right.
And it's the same people doing different shows. Here, it's the same companies doing different shows with different people.
With different people.
Yeah, and you get somebody think, well, that was great. And then you never see them again.
Yeah. And the people of the company are not oftentimes the same people in the shows doing the shows. They're just making the shows continue to happen and exist. And I find that if we can't find a way to get the people who are in the show and part of the family to want to stick around and be part of the next production in some capacity, or the next, not the next one, but the one after that, moving from being an actor to doing the lighting, from being a lead in the show to now being a guy who only comes in for 20 minutes of it. If we don't find a way to help get these little encapsulated families broken open, that companies find a lot of difficulty with longevity and tenure in ways that so many companies have trouble.
That's absolutely true. The problem is, it's the same people, and we get old.
Right.
I just don't know what causes that, but it does.
It does.
And you run out.
Yeah.
You know, the first generation of Gas and Light are long gone.
Yep.
Caught the back end of them when I started with them.
Right.
And of course, Jackie Brennan was born to it, so she knows them right from, you know, I mean, Jack Goth's
daughter is now the president of the company he started. It's pretty wonderful thing to see.
I worked with Jack, and he directed Anything Goes. That.
And I talk about longevity, and I talk about progression planning a lot with a lot of community theater companies. I mean, Windmill Theater seems to be doing it right in High River. I had no idea they've been doing two shows a year, large musical productions every single year since 1974. 50 years. This production that they just finished of Grease is their 99th production.
But that, you know,
amazing.
That's a town,
right?
With one company,
yeah.
And so, if you want to be in theatre, you go to Windmill. Same with Dewdney,
right?
Although, you know, I've done shows with Dewdney, and I know a lot of people who are heavily involved with Dewdney don't live in Okotoks, but the organization's there.
It's true. And there are other community theater companies that are in kind of Okotoks area as well that are springing up and developing and growing and becoming their own thing. Same in Calgary. The problem is, as I'm seeing it happened in Windmill as well, is that the people who are involved, who are looking to progress and pass on, teach these other young whippersnappers and bucks who are coming up. But those people then take that knowledge and leave and go start their own theater company.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that
constantly springs up in its own way, too.
But then, you know, they either succeed or they fail.
Right.
And if they fail, maybe they come back, you know.
that one can only hope.
I mean, yeah, Gas and Light, in a sense, I mean, it took us a long time to fail, debatable whether we did. But it was certainly when we started, we were probably 8 or 10 people. By the time we did the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, it was 2 of us.
Right. And that's hard.
And we couldn't do it anymore.
That is just labor without the love at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, doing one a year isn't too bad, at least, you know. But doing two, we decided couldn't do two anymore because you put one show to bed and you start the next one.
Exactly. If you're doing one show a year, you still have to be thinking about what you're doing next year as well.
Yeah, but so bad. You're not going to start it straight away.
It's true, but you got to request the rights. You have to think about what show you want it to be. And that is still deliberative time that you have to think about doing while you're currently doing the one show. And so folding into a workshop who has a large group of people and bringing the assets you've acquired in that time into workshop's fold ensures that at least one theater company continues to exist in going forward.
And I think Jackie likes to think that Workshop does the occasional Gas and Light type play. And this is one of them. Moon Over Buffalo is
wonderful.
One of them. Gas and Light's sort of mantra was comedy, farce, classics.
Yep.
I really like doing costume comedies like She Stoops to Conquer or Puts of Being Earnest. We did a whole bunch of those. And we were the only people doing those.
Yeah, that's true.
And I always felt that it was important that we should do them. I think any play that's been around for 200 years is probably a very good play.
Yeah, exactly. It can't just be Shakespeare's works. You know? Right? We shouldn't just be doing Shakespeare's works. There are other playwrights that have come along since then that have created things that are of lasting quality and value that should... I think that's why Morpheus continues to do a Gilbert and Sullivan every single year in order to create a history tying us to the past, showing us that there's quality of work that still exists.
And they're kind of right. I mean, I grew up with Gilbert and Sullivan. I grew up standing around the piano with a family singing songs from Gilbert and Sullivan, because my mother was involved in it. She, I think over the years, she did 54 different productions of Gilbert and Sullivan, either as an actor or as a director.
That's incredible. Well, when you're doing 2 a year, it's achievable. I don't know, only one happening a year in Calgary. That's tough.
But you know, she did a lot of theatre. I like the fact that my granddaughter is now the fifth generation of our family to go on the stage.
Oh, has she done Gilbert and Sullivan as
no,
well?
No, she hasn't.
Too?
She's not done any musicals, but
hey,
she's done plays. And
granddaughter of Jeremy, get out there and do a Gilbert and Sullivan and make your grandfather proud.
I don't know whether she'd be interested in that.
How can you not be interested in that? They are delightful entertainment.
They are. That's absolutely right. I sort of fell out of love with them for a while.
As one can.
I was listening to a record the other day of, I think it was the Gondoliers. I thought, you know, I really miss that in a way. I've done 9 different Gilbert Sullivans, but I've never done the Gondoliers.
Yeah, I'm at 8 different, 7 different Gilbert and Sullivans because I've done Pirates twice. So to that end, let's drive back to the show that we're really, this is what I'm interested in seeing is you're working hard on rehearsals. You said you're an actor's director while you've taken a bunch of things from Bill Torrey's tutelage and in mentorship over the years and just seeing how he does things. Your approach is, do you get up and mime things for the actors when you're looking for them to do a specific thing, or do you just use your words to guide them? What are you looking for?
I try and... I mean, if I think they're missing the point, I'll perhaps try and say it the way I think it should be said with them. I mean, Tim has several Shakespearean quotations
right
in the play, and I've sort of tried to help a bit with that, although he seems to need a lot of help. He's done fine. If they're missing the point of a joke...
They're not getting the beat for the joke.
We're not getting the joke. You know, if you don't understand what the joke is, you can't deliver it.
Right.
You know, why is this funny? You know.
Yeah.
Then I'll sort of try and point that out. But I'm sort of work one-on-one with people as we go along.
Right. And you load in this coming Sunday for your show to go up on the 10th.
Yeah.
Your whole tech week is still to come. What's been hard about bringing this show to life so far?
From my point of view, well, obviously casting was a bit of an issue for a while. And then we had some... It was a question of who was going to be my stage director. And then the set design, don't usually like to change my mind on set design, but I did on this one.
Oh, wow.
I abandoned the wagon for the Private Lives scene.
Right.
Mainly because I couldn't see how we could ever rehearse it, because we couldn't build it and have it in the rehearsal space.
Right.
Because there was nowhere to put it.
Right. Yeah, it would be stuck there.
It would be in the way. So we were sort of trying to rehearse without it. And I thought, well, you know, it's working well without it. Why do we need it?
Right.
So we can that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know. Everything else has gone relatively smoothly, I think.
That's amazing.
People get sick and that doesn't
As
help.
As they do, yeah.
But, you know, they can't help that.
No, they can't.
And people have reasons to not be at a rehearsal now and then. But we seem to have worked around that.
And it's hard knowing that a lot of this will come from having gotten to see the show, and once it's before the lights and there's an audience, that's when the genuine memories of all the events that have led up to that truly take hold. But what will you remember most about having gotten the chance to finally direct Moon Over Buffalo?
I think I'll remember that it was just such a funny play. I mean, it still makes me laugh. And maybe it's the way it's being put over. You know, Roz's monologue of improv on the balcony is hilarious, and she does it so well.
Oh, absolutely.
She has a problem, I think, just learning the words. Learning to say something that's nominally improvisation is really tricky.
Right.
But she's got the idea. You know, it's all about embarrassment and the fact that he's not there, and she can't, and she's run out of lines, and she's got to fill in. You know, it's come back to what you were saying earlier.
Right.
Things go wrong. Things are going wrong.
But,
dramatically wrong.
But within the structure of the play, they're gone wrong. And now you have to be believable in that moment.
So, so she does it differently every time. And I'm trying to not let her get too carried away, because otherwise she'll go over the top and spoil it.
Exactly.
And she does it so well.
And is that a moment for the audience that you really want
God,
them to
see?
Oh, God,
if the audience aren't rolling in the aisles, then we've failed. Absolutely.
Okay. And what's something else that the audience might not get a glimpse at, or they might not get a true understanding of?
Well, there's a few things in this.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what I'm trying to do with the opening, with the Serrano bit, you know, it's quite dramatic. It's from the play.
Yeah.
It's based on a real event.
Yeah.
Serrano really was at the Siege of Arras, and he got wounded. But the audience have come to see a comedy. And we start off with not a comedy.
Yes.
With a dramatic war scene.
Yeah.
But then it dies because, you know, they said, I am Serrano de Bergerac. And then the crowd say, hey. That's the point at which we hopefully all get a laugh.
Oh, good.
A bit of a a sort of a puzzled laugh, perhaps, you know, because what's going on?
What's happening here?
And then that's funny.
So look for that.
So I want to surprise the audience on that.
That's awesome.
And there's a couple of other things that places where I think we can surprise the audience.
How does the play being set in 1953 implicate today? It's 70 years, 71 years since 1953.
The only thing that I think we struggle with, and I've tried to avoid that, is the references. The references to actors.
Yeah.
So what I've done is I've actually done a brief bio for each of them. I'm going to put it in the biographies in the program.
Oh, wonderful.
So that people know who Ronald Colman was.
Because they
and
don't.
And Greta Garbo. I mean, I know who they were, but
it's the same
cast
thing.
Don't.
Right?
You know, they don't even know who John Gielgud is.
It's impossible. Or even better, like the Gondoliers talks about Wesleyan Republicans or Wesleyan Methodists, and no one in the audience knows what that is at all.
Well,
and that's 100 years ago. It's amazing.
Well, Gilbert had his,
send-ups.
Things he wanted, his send-ups, and a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan basically is of the age, and it was
it's
Gilbert sending
time,
it up.
Right? Like he was.
So if you don't know what it is.
Any sort of political commentary in a show is of that time, right?
Iolanthe is just a spoof on the House of Lords.
And specific people in the House of Lords.
Yeah. Well, at the time in the House of Lords is much more important than it is now.
It is. And so it's a similar thing from this production. Ken Ludwig said it in 1953 deliberately, and to retain it in 1953 does make it a bit harder to feel like the audience is going to have a harder time.
I think the reason, or one of the reasons, is that that was the point at which touring companies like theirs were running out of steam.
Yeah.
And I think it was about that time that I went to see probably the first professional play that I saw in Leicester with a touring company with Jack Hulbert and Cicely Courtnage, who were basically George and Charlotte.
Yep.
They were big stars from the 40s, reduced to touring a drawing room comedy.
As the age of color television took hold and regular film sitcoms happening every week, what was the need?
And this was all, this was a time, at least in England, when all the stage was all done in received pronunciation. Everybody spoke terribly well.
Right.
And then it was in the early 50s that we get Billy Lyre and things like that coming in with accents.
A new way of approaching dialogue.
And it was a really big change. And
yeah.
It was happening in music too. But so it was a very pivotal point, the early 50s.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing this with the advent and rise of streaming services and TikTok, and the way that TV has been made, even just 20 years ago, has changed considerably in that time. I think what's important and useful to look at from the lens that you're seeing Moon Over Buffalo in is that change is going to happen no matter what we do. It's how we react and respond to it, and how we view our own diminished role, and how we proceed forward, knowing that what we were before is not who we are now.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
And that's a good thing, if you've listened to this podcast, to go into look, when you're going to go watch Moon Over Buffalo, you have to think about what that implication is for each of these generations of people involved in this production.
Yes. I mean, it's basically the end of movies like The Scarlet Pimpernel.
Right.
And the beginning of things like Star Wars, which are probably essentially similar plots, but done differently. You know, there are only so many plots. But yeah, it was such a fundamental time of change. I was sort of fortunate enough to be growing up and going to school in that period.
Right at that time.
It was the end of the 30s, really.
Yeah.
And all right, we'd had a war in between, but life in the village I grew up in was still pretty much the same as it had been in the 1930s.
Yeah.
But it really changed by the time I left school.
Right. And by the time you had rolled into a family life and had a career, you've moved to Essex and there isn't even an Amdram society there anymore.
No, there wasn't.
Because it had probably failed and folded.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't even a theatre or even a room to have a theatre where I lived. Very East End where I was. It's very lots of people moved out there after the war.
And so this show's going to come up. There's been hardships you know, making decisions for one, finding the right people for another, and then getting this to be the sort of vision that you've wanted it to have for this production. What do you want audiences to take away from having gotten a chance to experience Moon Over Buffalo?
A sense of happiness, more than anything, that they've laughed a lot. I mean, yeah. It's a very silly play. It's a bunch of people. Nobody in this play is trying to be funny, and I tried to impress that on the cast. They are serious actors trying to cope with a series of disasters which are beyond their coping with, basically, but are largely their fault. And it's how you cope. Nothing funnier than people coping with disaster. The Michael Green series of one acts, The Art of Court Acting, and they're all hilariously funny.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Because there are people not managing to cope. So think that's funny. I mean, that's one of the essences of comedy,
right,
is the pratfall, if you like.
I always feel like that one of the essences of comedy, though, is also that it ends happily.
Oh yes, and
we find a way to overcome.
This does.
Yeah,
they're saved at the end, although they've come to terms with their failure by then.
Right,
and then they find they're saved and they back into it again.
Yeah, like this too shall pass is kind of like a message within Moon Over Buffalo as well. Like, you know, as long as you stay together, as long as you weather the storm and you don't allow it to defeat you, you will come through.
People have to adopt new attitudes as it goes along. George and Charlotte have to accept that perhaps their career as Broadway stars is probably over.
It's over. I'm doing productions in Buffalo.
Yeah. They haven't come to terms with that earlier on. You know, they're just upset they didn't get the role in this big movie.
Yeah.
Their daughter Rosalind has decided she's had enough of this crazy world that her parents live in, and she wanted to be normal and go into advertising, if that's normal.
Yep.
By the end of the play, she has to recognize that, no, she is an actress and there are opportunities. And a lot of people have big changes in the play,
right?
As a result of the,
it's
of
not
the
a good
disasters.
Play unless people change.
Well, no, it isn't really. But yeah, and you know, there is no villain. There's no
right. That's true. The villain is really the situation that they've been put in the first place.
And it's
place.
All down to George's fault, really.
Yeah, there isn't a wicked witch in the woods with a house of candy trying to lure the children away.
No,
this isn't that sort of show.
No, it's just a succession of disasters that they can't cope with one on top of another, to the extent that in George has to go out and get drunk, and then everything falls apart.
Everything falls apart. But it gets put back together in a new and interesting way, and the audiences are going to get a chance to see that collapse and rebuild and experience all the laughs that will come. 2 laughs a minute? 3 laughs a minute? What do you think?
Oh, I hope so, yeah. Always difficult to judge.
How will we know until it opens?
And you don't know from one night to the next.
Right, and you won't know either unless you go and see it. It opens at the Pump House on May the 10th. It runs until the 18th. There aren't that many shows happening. The link to tickets is in the show notes. And I cannot thank you enough for coming and sitting down and talking with me about this today, Jeremy. And I can't thank the listener enough for buying a ticket and going seeing something that will delight, entertain, and give them an opportunity to pause and think about how to come together as a group to get through a hard time.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. And I endorse your comment about buying the tickets.
Thanks for listening.